it's okay to feel sad. It's okay that I feel angry. It's okay that I feel hurt. It makes sense that I'm afraid. All of those things are okay to feel. And the next question is, how do I treat myself in a healthy way? Right? So if I'm mad, it's okay. If I need time to be mad, it's okay. What can I do that's healthy for me until that anger starts to move, you know, through me, right? Instead of pushing it down or hiding it or pretending it's not there, let me give space to it. Let me acknowledge it. And then also let me make intentional, healthy choices for myself.
Hey everyone, I'm Margot Alexis. Welcome to the Healing Cassandra podcast. Today on the show, we have Jess. Jess is in a neurodiverse marriage. She is the mother of three with a young son who was recently diagnosed on the spectrum, and she is a successful businesswoman. One of the many things I admire about Jess is that she has a growth mindset. Jess is willing to dig deep, be uncomfortable, and harness her resources in order to change and grow. Jess is also extremely compassionate, and she shares with us her thoughts on how important it is to practice grace in our relationships. Let's jump into this interview with Jess. Enjoy. Hi, Jess. Thank you so much for being here today. I know you're going to give us a lot of words of wisdom, and I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us. Why don't we start with telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. Well, first off, thanks so much for having me, Margot. This is, I think, such an important conversation for us to have, and certainly one that's obviously very near and dear to my heart. I am a mom of three and wife. I'm also a small business owner, and I am on a journey of awareness and understanding about neurodiversity in so many ways, both as a mom and as a wife. So that's me.
How long have you been married?
Just under 10 years now.
Oh, okay. And yeah. How far into the marriage was it when you discovered that something may be a little amiss?
Yeah. So it's interesting because this journey is sort of tied to my parenting journey, because over the past few years with my youngest son, we've been in a discovery mode of understanding his needs in terms of his neurology. And just recently, he was diagnosed on the spectrum. And when that happened, let's say in less than a year ago, just under a year ago, is when it started to click together for me that there were some patterns here. And I just started to really become aware that there was something going on, and that my husband also had a lot of those very similar traits and processes, but that they had been undiagnosed.
How has that changed your relationship with your husband now that you know that your son is on the spectrum? What has changed in that?
So I think it's constantly evolving, because it's such a process, I'm sure, as you know. So I think the first thing is just that it's created an awareness for me. And that awareness has taken a lot of acknowledging of emotion, of really sort of understanding. It kind of reminds me of the end of a movie where they reveal, you know, the secret, and you look back across the movie and you go, oh my gosh, it's all starting to make sense now. I've sort of been really living through that over the past just under a year in terms of understanding this. And I think it's done a couple of things. So number one, it's removed some of the anger and frustration I had about certain behaviors, because before I perceived them as a choice. In so many ways, I perceived that, okay, this was being done to me. Right? That I was receiving things as an affront, and I was assigning meaning that wasn't really there. So in one way, it was a relief, because I was able to say, hold on, there's this whole other thing happening that I wasn't aware of, that means none of this means what I thought it did. None of this has the intent behind it when it comes to hurt, that I thought it did. So that piece was a bit of a relief, but then there was this other side to it that's actually been challenging, and it's sort of an ongoing process. And that is the side of grief, because once you realize, okay, this is something that's coming from a neurological standpoint, then you also begin to understand this isn't a thing that can be changed in maybe the way that you thought it could before. So it's been twofold, you know, it's been a relief, but it's also been a process of experiencing grief in terms of coming to acceptance and acknowledgement of what it all means. And also so much homework in terms of trying to understand it, because I think it's also very, very misunderstood in terms of, you know, knowing what it means to be on the spectrum.
What's interesting to me is now you are seeing the dynamic, you know, through the eyes of your child.
Yes.
Who is on the spectrum.
Yes.
And I imagine the compassion and the empathy that you have of what his life is like every day. Yeah. And our husbands, you know, they grew up in a time where they weren't diagnosed. So
right.
There's no clue of what their behavior is and why they're behaving in a certain way. So how is that now that you see your child through the eyes of probably more empathy and compassion? And
yes,
how does that help you with your husband?
I think it's made a significant difference, because it's, you know, as I'm on a quest to constantly try to understand how to best support my son, it really helps me to know, okay, I need to be a person who is focused on his needs, right? Our typical mode of parenting and relationships is always outcomes focused. It's behaviors focused. And that doesn't work with the spectrum. It just doesn't work at all. They're consistently communicating in ways that we can't assign typical meaning to. So we're having to go on this sort of mission, right? This sort of investigative research position of trying to understand, okay, what is his need here? What is he trying to communicate with what's happening right now? There's something happening that he needs from me that he can't maybe necessarily use his words or express in a typical way. And so I've been able to translate that to situations, you know, in my marriage too, and say, hold on, there's something else happening here. It's not what it seems on the surface, right? If someone's, you know, melting down or they're speaking to you in a certain way, usually you can say, oh, this means, you know, they're mad. This means they're frustrated. This means something really simple and straightforward that you understand. But because it doesn't, I'm getting in the habit now and the process of saying, okay, let me give a little bit of space to this. Let me give a little bit of grace to this. Let me step back and try and have some compassion that there's something happening here that I may not understand. So it's definitely helped me in that way. I don't know how I'd be dealing with it if I didn't have that perspective of a mother. Because I also think back on what you just said, Margo, the fact that they grew up in a world without compassion for this. They grew up in a world without understanding of their needs, and they were constantly misunderstood and likely still are. Right. And yes. That hurts my heart. You know, that hurts my heart. And it definitely gives me compassion as well.
It does. And you said something very important is grace. It's so important to have grace in these kind of relationships. And often it's the most difficult thing to show compassion and empathy, because most of the time we get upset and bitter and annoyed and frustrated.
Hard.
And it's hard. It's very hard. Difficult. This isn't an easy thing, but you know, grace is a practice. Showing compassion is a practice. And like the Dalai Lama says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion.
That's right.
And that's, you know, that's often difficult to do. But, and it is something that we have to put into practice on a daily basis. But I want to get back to one thing that you talked about that I don't want to just pass over is grief.
Yeah.
And there is a grieving process. Now for you, there's a grieving process with your son that it's going to be different than maybe you thought, and with your husband.
Yeah.
And that's something that just doesn't go away. It is a process.
That's right. No, and it's interesting because I think sometimes we feel like when we're absorbing something significant in our lives, such a big shift of understanding and such a big shift in how we operate on the day-to-day, we think, grief is this thing that we do, right? We get through it. It's a thing we do, and then we did it, and then we move on. Right. And that's not the case with this for several reasons. Number one, this is just not how grief works, right? It doesn't disappear, doesn't go away. It shifts and it changes shape and it moves into different form at different times. But also, you and I discussed this before, you're constantly experiencing moments of mini grief, because when you're living in this circumstance, you're also constantly experiencing what I've started calling micro losses, right? And Essentially what that is it's just a really high volume of small disconnects. And because those of us who operate in a neurologically typical way, we were created for that connection, right? We were created in a way where we consistently desire to be understood, to be heard, to be seen, those kinds of things. We're constantly experiencing a loss of that. It happens daily. Sometimes it happens hourly. And so it's not the kind of thing that we can grieve once. It comes up in moments and in waves. And sometimes it hits us, and there's a high emotional cost to that. Right. And so We have to have things in place for our own needs. So being needs focused for me isn't just about understanding their needs better and more compassion to them, but it's also more compassion to myself and more grace to myself, more space to myself and more care for myself, and seeking alternative ways than what you might have in a typical relationship, so that I can navigate that, because it is hard, like you said.
What are some of the things that you do to care for yourself?
So I make jokes, but you know, ultimately we really have to do is I treat my self-care like it's life or death. I treat it like it's life or death. It is not optional. It's not a luxury for me. I must make choices about how I'm caring for myself on a daily and weekly basis. So sometimes that means making sure that I am, you know, taking my supplements. It means that I'm getting extra rest. It might mean that I'm taking a break and just giving myself some space away from the house. Or it might even mean sitting in my car before I come in, you know, for an extra 15 or 20 minutes. So I've just got that quiet and that peace. It could also mean that I just give myself the grace to have a moment and cry and break down, because it's hard, and really process and move through those emotions and give time to that and honor and respect those. Because I think that can be a challenge for us too.
Yes, I like what you said. And I think it's so important that you know when it's time for a break and you remove yourself from the situation, because in these kind of relationship, you do need a break. It's intense sometimes, it's draining. So one of the things that I found helpful is that I had to figure out and know my sources of rejuvenation.
Yeah.
And what I did was I made a list of things that I keep on the side of the refrigerator. So I don't even have to think twice about it. As soon as I feel a little bit tired or frustrated, I go to that list. And for example, on that list, it says towels. And that means to me, okay, maybe I'm going to go to Target and buy myself a new set of towels. And they're going to be just for me. Or, you know, gardening. Maybe I'm going to go out to the garden. Or or even, this is just a silly one, but it works for me. I like postage stamps. So I might just head over to the post office, because they always have really cool postage stamps. Yeah. And I'll buy another set of postage stamps. Or like you said, I will just go and sit and be quiet. And I think silence and being fully present with yourself, taking a few deep breaths, that can really help. And that can just rejuvenate you enough to go in to handle, I hate to say the next battle, but to just go back in and be rested.
I love your examples, because they're so specific to you, right? And that's the beauty, is that we get to define. And for me, it's been different things in different stages. I go through stages where I do a lot of meditation, right? I go through other stages where maybe I'm, you know, doing yoga, or maybe I just want to treat myself to a really great meal and just sit and enjoy it on my own in peace. Right. And that's the beauty of it, is that we get to decide what works best for us. I think when I notice I start to get in trouble is when I don't give that attention, when I don't intentionally say, okay, how can I take good care of myself this week? What does that mean for me this week? And on any given day or week, it could look different. But I love that you have a list, because sometimes we're in total fatigue in the moment we need it the most, and we can't even decide what we need. We don't even know what we need. So that's a great tip. I'm actually going to take that and put it into practice.
Oh, that's great. Because before, my go-to was always crawling back in bed and then ruminating. And that was my go-to because I was so fatigued. I was so run down and just exhausted. So now, you know, it's finding the moment that I start to feel not myself. Mm-hmm. And that could be, maybe I'm not sleeping quite as well. Maybe I didn't stop taking my vitamins. I stopped doing, you know, those things that I know are important. And I like what you said, that taking care of ourselves is life or death. I mean, healing and our health and well-being are all part of our self-care. And I know sometimes self-care gets, you know, a bad rap that it's just, you know, something frivolous, but it's not. It's very complex and it's much deeper than just getting a manicure or getting your hair done, which it can be those things.
Absolutely.
But, you know, also there's things that as we discover for ourselves what works for each one of us, it may not, what I do may not work for you. You may not be into postage stamps, but, but, you know, we all have those things. So, you know, just sitting down and, you know, making a list, putting it on there. So then I just go right to the list and I just pick one and just one that I'm moved to. And I do it because that keeps me going. That keeps my, momentum to stay in health, to stay and take care of my, emotional health. And I think that's the tricky part because it's so easy to, you know, let all of these emotions pile up and then we're overwhelmed. And the next thing you know, we have a cold or we're sick or we're in, you know, in the dumps. The other thing that I do is I always schedule something to look forward to, whether it's a, you know, dinner date with girlfriends, a trip to the museum. In my month, I schedule something that I know that I want to do that I'm going to look forward to.
That's for you. And I love that because I think one of the micro losses and one of the elements of grief is absolutely that, and this is, you know, I'm making a generalization here, but I think one of the challenges relationally with neurodiversity is that that other person isn't always looking out for the things that you need, right? Or they don't always know which things actually make a difference to you. And so you have to do that for yourself in a lot of ways, right? Or you have to find alternate ways to do that. So I think what you've just pointed to of making sure that, you've got something on the books that matters to you, that's just for you because you deserve it and you're worthy of that. And I'm working to also go even above and beyond that and just making sure that I'm ahead of it. So I think sometimes what happens is we get to that moment that you described where it's like, uh-oh, I'm not feeling like myself. I'm curling up in the fetal position. Uh-oh, what do I do to fix it? Right. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I live in the place where, you know, obviously those moments happen, but how do I live in the place where I am really recharging myself enough that those moments are happening less often? Right.
Right. But what about Jess? What about the stumbling block that we feel sometimes that we're not receiving compassion back from him. We're not receiving the reciprocity. So how can I continue in this relationship when I'm not getting back what I need?
Right. And I think that's the sort of like the $1 million question, right? That every person who finds themselves in a neurodiverse relationship has to answer. And we each have to answer that for ourselves. And I think it's a tough one. Because on some days, it really feels like, okay, this doesn't work. I can't live like this, right? And then there are other days where we feel like, okay, you know, I can do this. I've taken care of myself enough. I've found alternate ways to meet my needs. And ultimately, that's what it is figuring out, okay, what are the ways that my needs can be met? My, you know, non-negotiables can be met. Can I make that work in this context? Because in so many cases, it's not from them. As much as we would want it to be from them, we either have to accept it coming in a different way, whatever their capacity is, right? Because I don't want to make generalizations about how they care for others, because it's different for different people, right? There's such a wide range. That's why it's called a spectrum. There's such a wide range of how, responses come across and how people interact in their relationships when they're on the spectrum. So we have to make that decision and say, okay, I'm noticing that here's how he operates. Here's his way of showing me love. And that might not be my way. It might not be one of my top five love languages. Am I willing to take that and translate it, right? Am I willing to take that and say, okay, I know what he's trying to do. And I'm willing to look at intent. And that's different than a typical relationship. Because in a typical relationship, right, you have these expectations and you assign meaning. And of course, that comes with its own challenges. But you have to make the decision, okay, am I willing to say, okay, I know that this is him expressing his love for me in the way that he can and in the way that makes sense to him. Now, is that something that I can accept and that I can supplement from other ways so that my needs are being met? Now, it doesn't mean things are perfect. And it doesn't mean I don't have grief and I don't feel loss at moments, because I do. And there are moments where I break down about it because it feels sad, right? Especially for those of us who uncover this later on, which is most all of us, right? I think nowadays we're starting to get to the stage where people are realizing they're actually choosing neurodiverse relationships. But I think a lot of people who are in your or my situation didn't choose it. They didn't know, right? They're becoming aware of it much later. And so they're experiencing it in a whole different way. So then it's a matter of making that decision. And that's a tough one. I wish there was a simple answer to it, but there's not. It's sort of a daily process of being creative, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I found it helpful once I dropped my expectation of how I thought he should show empathy, compassion.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he's just not capable of it. So, I didn't find out that my husband was on the spectrum until 4 years ago, and I've been married 26 years. So all of those years, I like how you said in the beginning, it's the movie when the reveal is, and then they could do the montage of going back and showing you, da 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 da. This is what the big reveal is. And I felt that exactly. Now I know I have to shift my thought process, my expectations, and not expect things of him that it's not available to him. He can't give. So I think, dropping the expectations of how I expect him to show me compassion and show me empathy and replace it with something else. I've been able to replace it with, okay, he, may not bring me flowers all the time, but he's willing to stand in line for 30 minutes to pick up my prescription when I don't feel well. It's finding things, within. And again, that goes back to talking about compassion and grace, doesn't it? It's not always the way we want it to look.
Yeah. And I like that you use that word expectations, because I think we can become so married to our expectations. And if we want to stay in these relationships, we need to make a choice. Would we rather be married to our expectations, or would we rather be married to our husbands? Right. And that's a very real choice. And some people will say, no, these are non-negotiable for me and they must come from my spouse. And in that case, we have to make that choice. Right. But if we have that willingness to, like you said, make some shifts and say, oh, now that I know he's not doing this on purpose, right? He's doing his best. He's using everything within his power to love me well in the way that makes sense to him. Right. Yeah. And so it's up to us if, which one we want to do. And again, it can shift. Because I think we've all had moments, right, where we go, oh my gosh, it's too much, it's too hard.
Definitely. And you're realizing that if you're going to stay married, that you're playing the long game. You're in the long game. And you may have some moments of short-term successes that add up. And I noticed once I changed my focus from him to me and started working on myself, digging deep, doing the work, changing some of my behavior, I saw that it you know, was helpful. And also for the first time, I felt some hope in my marriage. You know, for many years, I was very unhappy. And I think a lot of the women out there are unhappy and they say, will I ever be happy in my marriage?
Right. Right. And that ultimately, I like what you're describing, because ultimately our happiness is in our hands. If we ever, you know, and that's, you know, neurodiverse or not, it's up to us to make those decisions, and not to say that it's hard, not hard, or oversimplify it, but that's the fact of the matter. And I think one of the reasons that we get stuck in those moments of feeling that, like feeling like this will prevent us from being happy, is because we've gotten in a cycle of pressure. And our spouses, our partners, they feel that pressure. And when it comes to being on the spectrum, pressure never generates a good result. It never generates a good feeling. It never generates a good result. I mean, I think that's just in life, right? But certainly in this circumstance, I've noticed that if I'm, you know, feeling agitated or like, he better do this, I hope he does that, even if I'm not saying it, my husband can feel that from me. He feels that tension. He feels the weight of that expectation and that disappointment. And that's not helping him. That's not encouraging him. That's not making it easier for him, right?
Right.
To navigate all of this. And it's not easy for them to navigate marriage either, just like it's not easy for us.
No. And one thing that I work on is containing my criticism, because it becomes so easy to criticize when he doesn't do things the way I expect him to do them. And then I start to micromanage, and that's, you know, that's not good. I have to realize that his thought process is totally different than mine.
Not the same. That's right.
And what I'll do sometimes, again, to practice compassion, I'll go in to his office and I'll pull a book off the shelf, like a book on tensor calculus or quantum physics. And I'll open it up and I'll look at all of those, you know, math problems, and I'll start to read it and I'll say, I don't understand a thing in here. Right. I could never answer any of these math problems. He understands everything in here, which is so amazing to me. So that would be very difficult for me. So the things that are easy for me that I expect to be easy for him, like, why don't you know this? This is the way you do it. It's hard for him. So that is just a little trick that I sometimes, you know, again, it's a way of practicing grace and compassion.
I love that.
He thinks differently than me.
I really love that you described it that way. And I think whatever way we can get our heads around, it is important to understand that it's not about them trying to do something. It's not about, right, them doing it. It's like, for a long time, this, you know, the neurodiversity masked as a language issue, because we have three different languages in our house. So I always assumed it was a language barrier problem, when the fact of the matter is, it has a lot of similarities. You would never approach a person who speaks Mandarin and be angry at them for not talking to you in English, right? It wouldn't make any sense. You would understand they're operating with a different set of language tools,
right.
a whole different, so they're operating with a different set of tools in terms of how they process, in terms of how they perceive, in terms of their awareness, in terms of their social interaction, in terms of a lot of things, a range of things, depending on the person. So it just doesn't make sense for us to keep running into that brick wall and saying, why don't you do it this other way? Why don't you do this other thing, right? It's like expecting someone to speak a language they don't speak. It's unreasonable. And so we have to realize we've got to be willing to let go of the expectations that may seem, air quotes, normal. They may seem perfectly fine and no big deal. They're unreasonable in the case of neurodivergence in a lot of ways. So it's important to understand that and to not just be aware of that, but also to recognize that this is bigger than just us. Sometimes I think about the context of the world and our communities and our schools, right? A lot of people don't have an understanding of all of this. And so the compassion that's out there in the world, think about what our husbands and our kids are experiencing when they're out in the world, in the workplace, in their school, and they're running into all of these conflicts and they're struggling with navigating them. It's hard.
It is hard. But when we're married, we have big decisions that we have to make as a couple about our finances, about where we're going to live. And those are often difficult conversations, especially if you're speaking two different languages.
Oh,
what are the things you've implemented? Do you have any things that you have implemented that has helped you in that communication process?
Yes. And I think saying that it's difficult is an understatement, especially because when you're talking about things that carry a lot of weight in your life and in the life of your family, it can really trigger a lot for everyone. Right. And so one of the things that I've found is that it's so important for me to be more patient with those conversations. It's also really important for me to do some priming for those conversations and make sure that I'm really thoughtful about the timing. So if I start to see that something's getting stressful or we're in a moment of crisis, that's not the time to make the big decision about, you know, should we move or do you take this? That's not the time to have that discussion, right? So before those discussions, saying, okay, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I know this is really important to you. When's a good time for us to talk about it? When do you want to touch base? Giving agency, making sure that they understand that you respect their opinion, their decisions, and that you want to hear and you want to collaborate and you want to work together and that you're open and really doing whatever you can to diffuse tension about it. So being very careful of what you said earlier, not making those complaints or throwing any digs or doing things that we could easily naturally do because these things come emotionally charged, but really trying to be as neutral and as patient as possible with those conversations. I also try to ask more questions than statements. So priming, prepping the conversation, being thoughtful about timing, and also asking questions. So if he says something, you know, let's say, for example, he's like, well, I think we should move here and we should leave the state and do this thing, right? That to me feels like crazy and off the wall and totally disregards everything about life, which happens in conversations, right? Instead of me kind of having that reaction, what are you talking about? That's crazy. Why would we do that? That doesn't make any sense, right? So instead, stepping back, taking a breath and saying, huh, okay, let me just approach this from a neutral, curious standpoint. Okay, tell me more about that. Oh, what do you think would happen with this? Huh, how would we handle that? So really trying to be as neutral as possible and managing your tone and your timing, I think makes a huge, huge difference for sure.
I think tone is also very important and timing, like you said, there's, three critical moments that I'm mindful of during the day with my husband. It's when we first get up in the morning, when mm-hmm. we see each other after work, and then when we say goodnight. And, you know, then when we have to have these big conversations, I need to be mindful where he's at. If he comes home from work and he's had a bad day, this is not the time.
Don't do it. Yeah.
Bring up the taxes. Don't do it. And I know for my husband that he likes things, you know, written down. So I remember after we first met, he made on the computer these little, like a memo pad that was avoid verbal orders. And he wanted me to write a list of things that I wanted. And I just thought that was really strange, but now right. It makes sense. You know, yeah. It's AVO. It was an AVO card. He's an engineer. So just avoid verbal orders. Let's go through each, you know, point at a time. And
that's
how he, you know, processes things. But the other thing that you were speaking to was I try not to use you statements because it is very difficult when they come up with something. You're like, I'm thinking like, we're not doing that.
That's right.
Absolutely not. What are
That's
you
right.
thinking?
That's
and
right.
then I, you know, if I resort to, well, you always do this or you,
right.
you, then they feel accused and they feel criticized and that's not
right.
helpful.
That's
and
right.
I also noticed that tone of voice, I've really yeah. worked on that. That's because I know I tend to get emotionally charged in my voice. And the other thing is my husband is not always able to tell or read people's voices. Like he always says I'm yelling at him
mm-hmm.
and that's how he hears it, that I'm yelling at him.
Sure.
And so that's one thing that I've become aware of, that when I talk even animated, he perceives it as I'm being very loud and I'm yelling at him. So
sure.
I've tried to practice, and again, this is all right, Jess, this is all practice. It's all process, constant. So I've been practicing, you know, tone of voice is very important.
Yeah. Which also means we need to be mindful of our timing, right? So I know I cannot have the patience that I need or the positive tone or all of those things that we know make a difference if I'm hungry or if I'm tired, right? Yeah. That's just, it's off the table for me. I don't have the capacity, right? I can't do it. So I think being really thoughtful about those things is really valuable. And I think sometimes we overlook the value of being able to also speak positively to them. So if we give a little bit of extra time and say, okay, hold on, is there a you statement that I can make that's accurate about this? And I'm going to say, you know, I can tell how much you want to make sure that our daughter's okay. I can tell how much you care about this. I love that this matters so much to you. And I want to do what I can to support you. Right. So it's just, I think sometimes we just skip over that because we're just like, fix the problem, solve the thing, get the answer, you know, instead of trying to care for them the way that we also want to be cared for, right? Whether they can reciprocate it or not, you know, I think doing that is really powerful in terms of healing wounds in our relationship and healing wounds in our communication and in supporting them well also.
Right. I think giving my husband praise has really been helpful. Yeah. And that's something that I make a concerted effort to do, that when he does do something that, you know, is for me or for the good of our family, that I praise him for that.
And we acknowledge it. Yeah.
Yeah. That we acknowledge it. And the other thing that I know I'm working on is trust. Is I want to take over everything and have it done my way.
Yep.
And I'm starting, and then of course, you know, then we start to bitch and that, like, I have to do everything. And so I started to say to myself, okay, what can he do that I don't have to put my nose in that business, you know, that I can, can trust him to do? I mean, there's certain things that he can do, and I have to let go of, you know, again, maybe it's not done the way I want, maybe not be the exact income, but it's not life or death. These are small things, like, you know, that he can definitely handle. And then that empowers him when he does it. And sometimes he may not do it exactly the way I want, but just to not criticize him for that, just let it go, Margo. How much does it matter in the whole scheme of things? Can I let this go?
Yeah. And I think that's honestly one of the most powerful things that we can do is letting go. It's that surrendering, right? Especially for, I know you and I have similar personality types. And so if you're a type A person, right? Or you're the kind of person who wants things done a certain way and who has, you know, ideas about how things should be, it takes a lot of surrender. It takes a lot of letting go. And it takes a lot of giving up control of things, because it's not life in general, we can't control, but life in a, you know, neurodiverse relationship, 100%, you're not in control, right? Yeah. The only thing you control is you, and that is it.
Exactly. Because the dynamic and the day-to-day, it can change on a dime.
Absolutely. It can be very unpredictable. Yes.
Unpredictable. Something can be going absolutely fine, and then a meltdown will happen.
It feels like out of nowhere, like you don't have any kind of warning, you know, and that can be unsettling. And so that practice of letting go, the better you get at it, the better it is for everyone ultimately.
Yeah. And letting go, again, it's another process. All of these things on our path to healing are a process, eh?
Absolutely. A process and a practice. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, you're going to try things and it will work and maybe it won't work. But I know when you shift the focus and you do put things into practice, you're doing it, you know, for your benefit, for your health, but then that can spill over into the benefit for the family, the benefit as a wife, because then we can show up in a better place for our family and for our husbands, you know, when we do take care of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately that's what we want, right? We all, you know, We all chose our relationships because we love that person out of love, out of commitment, out of wanting to support them and be connected to them. It just looks a little different than maybe we imagined, right?
Exactly. And I think not always focusing on the negative traits of my husband, but the positive traits. Like my husband's very funny. He has just a wicked sense of humor. And that's one of the reasons I fell in love with him. And, you know, he's such a smarty pants. And sometimes I can get so annoying because it's all facts and figures. But on the other hand, I do enjoy that because I know if I want to know about something, he will research it and I will get, you know, all of the facts and you know, because that's, he knows that that's, you know, what he does. So it's sometimes, you know, finding the grace and being grateful for, okay, what were the things that, you know, what are the things that keep me in this relationship that I do love about him?
Absolutely. Yeah. What drew you in the first place? What are the things that you admire? Because sometimes those get buried over time. Right.
Well, one thing I think a lot of women, and I could say it was true for me too, when we got married, we felt like we were marrying one man and then it switched. It was like, it's like the bait and switch when you go to the car dealership, you know?
Right.
You know, that's what sometimes gets so frustrating.
Absolutely. And I think that's a part of the process that we a lot of times have to heal. You know, if we've made the decision that we're going to work through these challenges, is that we have to heal that mistrust that's created by that, because it can also be just, it's a false sense, right? Because in most cases, now, in most cases, when it comes to what we're discussing, this isn't about intent. It isn't about them saying, I'm going to pretend to be this one person. And then, and then one day, once we're married, and once I've got her, I'm going to just completely change. Even though it may seem that way from the outside, right? What we understand is that whatever was when we first met or when we were dating or what have you, just was something that couldn't be sustained.
Right? Exactly. It's, you know, we've heard the word masking, that they're masking.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they learn from modeling. So maybe
coping strategies. Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe they're able to do that, you know, for a while, say, okay, now I'm going on a date and then I act this way and then I'm supposed to send her flowers. And again, it's a list of tasks for him, you know, kind of like how to get the woman, 1, 2, 3, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's hard to sustain. So you don't see it at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Because what we're perceiving as, oh, this is just natural for them, is really them working to function in life and in social situations, right? And doing what they're always having to do, which is compensate. And like you said, mask in so many ways. And I think that's also something that helps me have a little more compassion, because I try to imagine, wow, what if I had to pretend all day, every day that I think one way, or that this thing makes sense to me, even though it doesn't. Right. And everyone I come in contact with thinks that thing, but I feel a completely different way, but I have to pretend I agree with them all the time. Right. That's really challenging. And so knowing that they're experiencing that and knowing that they're doing that and understanding that there's a cost for them emotionally and mentally to doing that helps me release a little bit of the expectation and also have a little more compassion and really see my husband a little bit better for who he is and what he's been through, because they have an entire experience of this that we have no idea about. And, you know, I'm very much on a quest of trying to understand that better too.
Yes. And understand it better for your son as well.
Absolutely.
Because now his experience will be different because he has you as a mom who can teach him different things, give him tools that he can use so that when he, you know, grows up and he starts to have relationships, he's going to have a whole toolbox ready to meet the world because you've supported him and he's had support all along, where our husbands did not have that support.
Well, and my goal is that he'll move through life with less trauma as a result of that, right? That even though I may not be getting it right, because we're always sort of guessing, okay, how do I meet his needs? How do I make sure he's supported well? Mm-hmm. How do I influence and advocate for him so that his environments are also supporting him well? And again, it's not perfect. I'm doing my best, but hopefully my hope is that he'll come into his adulthood and his relationships and his work life and all those things with less trauma, right? Because imagine how traumatic growing up your whole life being misunderstood, you know, constantly.
Yeah. And how is your husband doing now in his relationship with your son?
You know, I think they have a real special understanding. They understand each other, I think, better than anyone else does. But I think it's also been a real emotional process too, to become aware of what all this means, and to not feel any of the sort of negative feelings, you know, or to process those, I should say, because negative feelings are natural, right? It's natural to be upset or sad or feel loss or feel grief or feel worry or all those things, but to really not assign any shame or guilt or those kinds of things to it or judgment about it, I think is a process still. And that's a lot. It's a lot to take on. So I think from my perspective, you know, I don't want to speak for him, but my best guess, even though I guess wrong a lot, is that he's still navigating a lot of that.
Yeah, it is such a process to get through and to navigate. And it's not, it's definitely not easy. And I like what you said, because it's so true that it's natural to go to the negative, you know, that it's, and it's easy to have the fear come up and the anger and the bitterness. Sure. It's hard to stay positive. It's hard to manage our emotions, to keep moving forward, to shift our thinking, to change the paradigm so that we can keep moving forward in a positive light. To, you know, towards health and well-being. It's when we stay in that negativity that, you know, it's a dark place to be, but it is more difficult to get out of that. And again, as we've said over and over, it does take practice to move forward. Again, you know, putting your one foot in front of the other to do all the things, you know, necessary to take care of yourself and to, you know, maneuver the challenges and difficulties that come our way.
Yeah. And that's ultimately my goal, is to establish that pattern for all of my children. I've got three kids, and, you know, not just for my youngest son. It's really to say, okay, it's okay to feel sad. It's okay that I feel angry. It's okay that I feel hurt. It makes sense that I'm afraid. All of those things are okay to feel. And the next question is, how do I treat myself in a healthy way? Right? So if I'm mad, it's okay. If I need time to be mad, it's okay. What can I do that's healthy for me until that anger starts to move, you know, through me, right? Instead of pushing it down or hiding it or pretending it's not there, let me give space to it. Let me acknowledge it. And then also let me make intentional, healthy choices for myself. Do I need to get some space and have some quiet time? Do I need to cry? Do I need a hug? Do I need to, you know, have a moment where I get to go and, you know, hit the ball or do something physical and get that energy moved through my body? Whatever it is, that all those things are okay, and that we need to create space and grace for all of that. Every single one of us needs to do that.
Exactly. And it is not pushing and stuffing those feelings down. If I'm angry, sit with the anger.
Right.
See why I'm angry. And just sometimes just being with it and not stuffing those feelings back down, because then one builds on top of the other. And pretty soon, you know, you have just a whole mess of feelings there that you can't, it becomes overwhelming. You can't deal with all of those feelings. So it's checking in with yourself. Absolutely. I know that I've had to do that. I check in with myself, you know, what am I feeling now? Oh, I'm angry. And then for me, I do art journaling, because that's a way of processing.
I love that.
I recommend, you know, people find, you know, a way when they are experiencing, you know, feelings like anger and that, you know, whether it's meditation, going for a walk, just, yeah. but being able to sit with those feelings yeah. and process them and not stuff them down.
Journaling has been really therapeutic for me too. I think that's a pretty important part right now of my journey. And also creating the space to have new awareness, right? Because we're constantly learning new things, you know, about how to navigate this, how to be healthy, how to heal, how to take care of ourselves, how to take care of our loved ones. And for me, journaling has been a huge part of that. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yes, I do the art journaling, and that is just wonderful for me because I just, you know, put all the paints and the markers, and I just let my mind go. I'm not aware of time. I don't even know what I'm putting on the page. I don't even go in with an intention, or sometimes I will, you know, have something specific that I'm angry about, and I will go in with that, and then I just let like my subconscious mind take over, wow. and it just all goes on the page. And, you know, 4 hours will go by and I'll step away and I'll look at it. And I find it freeing. I find it really relaxing to me and healing.
Absolutely. And that's an important part of our self-care, right? Is finding a way to express whatever that is for us, you know, through creativity, through movement, through our writing, our words, whatever it is. So I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Jess. This has been an awesome hour. I just really learned a lot from you, going to put some things into practice. And I wish you well along your journey, and I hope you'll come back again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Margo. And I've loved this conversation. And I love, you know, the thought and the support that you give to this, because I think that's the key thing, right? Is that we're not alone in this, and that we can navigate this one day at a time. And that if we have support with us, it makes all the difference. So I appreciate you so much.
Wow, what a great conversation. Thank you for joining us. If you love this episode, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss a show. And make sure you visit our website, healingcassandra.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you can stay connected and gain access to all our resources. Until next time.